Formal bills we can work.
Do not do any worse. Open up the Committee on House Business and Labor for March 27th, 2013.
The opponents have done a good job.
This is going to be kind of a crazy day. We're going to be opening and closing and opening and closing. A lot of us up here have to go testify under the bills, so there'll be some changing faces. So just a little warning. We're going to open, since Representative Hovey has to leave for a hearing, open up House Bill 2535 for a public hearing. And Jan, if you can give us a summary.
Madam Chair, committee members, this bill requires workers' compensation rates for clients of temporary service providers to be based on the client's experience rating. Requires a temporary service provider to provide workers' comp coverage for the employees provided to the client, and it prohibits the client of the temporary agency from paying the employee if the employee is being paid by the agency. Instructs the Department of Consumer and Business Services to report information to the Department of Revenue and the Employment Department.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm going to give you just a little brief rundown of House Bill 2535 and its transition. We are considering the Dash 2 amendments at this point, which have substantially changed the bill. I've been working with some of the staffing company representatives in trying to refine this bill. First, I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about the problem that this bill is attempting to try to solve or at least minimize in the marketplace. It has to do with workers when they are assigned to a job through a temp agency, oftentimes, and especially in the construction industry, which is why I became aware of it. They will work for the temp agency and turn in a time card for, let's say, for example, 20 hours. And then the client of the temp agency, the employer, will make an arrangement with that employee to say, well, listen, I'll pay you off the books for the other 20 hours, and I can pay you a little bit more because it won't cost me as much because I don't have to pay the temp agency. And a lot of times these payments are without withholdings, without workers' comp insurance, without unemployment insurance. And the old adage goes that when the worker's on the roof, he's sort of off the clock, working under the table, and he falls, and by the time he hits the ground, he's back on the clock for the temp agency. This has huge implications for our workers' comp fund, as well as the unemployment trust fund, and of course payroll taxes as well. So this bill, I've tried to narrow it down and specifically try to address this so that it is not too cumbersome for the temp agencies. And so I've dramatically reduced this bill and work with the Workers' Comp Division and everybody else to where this bill doesn't even isn't even requested to go to IMLAC anymore because it just directly deals with the agreement and making sure that its employees and the employers know that they're not supposed to hire an employee simultaneously with the temp agency and the employer for the same time period unless they're being transitioned to a full to a permanent position with the company. The bill is relatively a simple concept, and you will see that in the Dash 2 amendments, it sort of walks through what is in the agreement between the temporary service provider and the employer client of that temporary service provider, and it's basically keeping track of the hours. And it's also keeping, making sure that the agreement that everybody knows what the rules are about this and putting some documentation in place so that this kind of abuse or I guess can be identified and hopefully somewhat reduced or curtailed. That's essentially the bill in a nutshell, and I'm hoping that the temp agencies who I've been working with are maybe not fully supportive of this Dash 2. We've still been working on it as recently as 2 days ago. I've been trying to address their concerns and to the point where I'm pretty comfortable with the Dash 2s. They may still want to see a couple of changes, but I am concerned about making so many changes that the bill does nothing at some point. So I will let them kind of walk through how they see this bill working, and that's it.
Yeah. Are there any questions of Representative Holvey? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. You said this has huge implications for the workers' comp.
Yeah.
Fund. So I'm wondering, do you have any idea how prevalent this situation is?
Chair Doherty, Representative Thatcher, just anecdotally, I know that it's an issue. I don't think there's any statistics on this, really, because nobody really knows. It's something, if we had statistics, we would be knowing that it was illegal to start with. And so, if we haven't caught in many instances of this, then it's pretty hard to have any data on that. I do know that it exists from my experience in talking to people in the industry. And the whole thing is that the people that are in the industry who do pay wages with the benefit packages like workers' comp for employees full-time have a really difficult time competing with somebody who is skirting that system by paying under the table or paying in cash and not paying those same amounts into the trust funds and into the payroll taxes.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Representative Holvey. So I close the public hearing on House Bill 2535 and open up the public hearing on House Bill 3342. Representatives Barker and Dembro. And if
good job.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the Business and Labor Committee. I'm Michael Dembro. I represent House District 45, that's Northeast Portland, out to Park Rose. It's a pleasure to bring you House Bill 3342. It's an important bill for Oregon's public employees and for those who use Oregon's public services. As you know, Oregon's collective bargaining law allows employees to form a union if a majority of those of the employees choose to do so. But in some public workplaces, management takes extraordinary steps to block unions, to block workers from forming a union, using substantial public tax dollars to hire outside labor relations firms that specialize in blocking organizing drives. When an employer tries to disrupt a union organizing drive, this has a negative effect on the workplace, including decreased productivity and a hostile work environment. And if workers do successfully go on to form a union, it creates a more difficult time coming to agreement over a first contract and moving forward cooperatively. I've seen this firsthand many times. So let's turn the clock back 30 years. No Barton jokes, I promise. Back in the early 80s, I first got involved as a faculty activist at my college. When I was a part-time teacher at PCC, and we were trying to form ourselves into a union with the goal of being better supported as educational professionals. College management at that time, unfortunately, resisted this effort strenuously, pouring many thousands of dollars into trying to convince our colleagues that our unionizing would result in harm to students. They engaged in a number of actions to block our effort. The result was poisonous, expensive, and divisive, and it took a number of years to get over, and it was unnecessary. Today, everyone at PCC would agree that the union has had a very salutary effect on the college and has really helped to provide stability and enhance service. It has helped to make the college the premier institution that it is. So let me fast forward to a happier story. By the late 1990s, when the faculty decided that it was in our best interest to merge the full-time and the part-time faculty units, college management could have again gone through that whole expensive, time-consuming, and divisive process of fighting the effort, seeking to pit teacher against teacher, but instead decided to remain neutral. The result was a very positive process, the sign of a healthy, mature workplace environment. That's what this bill seeks to do for all of our public sector workplaces. It requires that public employers remain neutral in organizing campaigns, just as they are required to remain neutral in elections and other political activities. This notion of neutrality is vital if public employees are to exercise their rights under collective bargaining law, free of intimidation and fear of reprisal. Neutrality by the employer, who inevitably wields an unequal level of power and influence, is vital if we're to maintain a level playing field. And it is equally vital that public tax dollars not go into deterring employees from exercising their legal bargaining rights. The bill also includes another element that's located in Section 4, which deals with a related issue, which seeks to correct a longstanding unintended consequence of a bill that the legislature passed back in 2007, House Bill 2891, which allowed public employees to form unions without having to go to an election. They could form a union if a majority of the bargaining unit indicated they wanted to be part of a union by signing cards showing that intention. The way that law has been applied over the years is it's only being applied to brand new bargain units. But if there is an existing unit that where there are other personnel that seek to become part of that unit, that's what's called a unit clarification. There, they're being forced to go to a formal election, which is, again, time-consuming, expensive, and unnecessary. So this bill would correct that. It would allow them also to go through the card check process, which I would argue is better for everyone. Colleagues, I urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and Committee. I'm Jeff Barker, House District 28 up in Beaverton, Aloha. And I just want to look back on time a little bit and why it's bad for the public employer, to try to stop union activity. I was in the Oregon State Police in the early 1970s, and during the first few years I was there, there was people that thought we should have a union. We had no overtime pay. We had limited medical coverage. We had virtually no rights. And the management interfered in that in every way they could. They threatened people. When they finally were going to take a vote, the officers that worked at Astoria, the lieutenant down there, the commander, would take them one at a time and drive them in a car to Milwaukee to cast their vote and talk to them all the way in there about why they should vote no. They turned workers against each other. They would, you know, say so-and-so wants a union, he's bad, and they would, different stations, because you were spread out, a different commander could say, Jeff Barker's this terrible guy up at St. Helens, he's really bad, people don't know me, you know, we didn't know each other. They would just cause real disruption that was unnecessary. They would, a station boss would bring up the evils of a union and say, how can these outsiders help us? And you say, well, you ask Sergeant, and we'll take a look and compare it to the Portland Police Association, where they have these different benefits. They would really get mad. The superintendent about across the street here about ripped my head off when I suggested we should compare salaries to other departments. And many careers went on the rocks. State police, good state police, and I'll take myself out of that picture, but people who would have been great state police officers with careers were doomed because they favored having collective bargaining because it's caused by the management versus labor sort of thing. Compare that to today. I just spoke with the superintendent. He's delighted with the union. They're working together cooperatively, as they should, and he can superintendent can concentrate on things, the union can concentrate on bargaining. And it just helped them all out. It just doesn't make any sense for a public employer to interfere with an organization. It's an organizing effort on the job. It really makes it tough on the workers because you get people, you know, fighting each other on the job instead of doing their job. And so for taxpayers' dollars, it's much better if people, if they want to try to form a union, let them do it. And again, they're not doing it while they're working. And so the management shouldn't be trying to stop that while they're working. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Barton.
Representative Barker, and if you want, I can ask you this later. But, you know, I always knew that you started your career at OSB and then spent the bulk of your career at PPB. Is that why you transitioned? I never knew why you transitioned.
That was a major reason for the transition. They had, if you favor a union, you would get jammed up on any little thing. They would kind of, and one week I had worked back to back shifts, 16 hours. We didn't get an overtime, as you recall, and I'd worked, I can't remember, but it was close to 60 hours that week. And I got called in. They said, "You didn't work 8 hours this day." And I said, "But look, Sergeant, I worked all these hours." They said, "You're not a union. We don't pay overtime here. You work 8 hours a day." And I got in my state police game warden pickup truck, and I drove into Portland to the civil service unit and went in and signed up and started taking the test in Portland that day.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both for being part of this bill and for carrying the load today. I'm supportive. I'm also a sponsor. The thing, you know, I pride myself on our labor management relations, and I think that most labor folks do, and they try to spar that. I find it interesting how much management needs labor when it comes time to push a public safety levy or something of that nature. They come to the union and say, "Our hands are tied. We can't really talk about politics, but you guys can if you can go do this." And so you end up with the collective bargaining unit out there just carrying the load. So I appreciate what you're trying to do and what we're trying to do here, and very supportive. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think both of you described as situations that were opposition against the union organizing and the use of taxpayer funds. I think the balance, too, in terms of the public's interest, is that these funds presumably should not be used for the promotion of any kind of union activities as well.
That's right.
That's correct. This bill calls for neutrality. Mm-hmm.
They didn't allow me to drive people from Astoria to Milwaukee telling them to vote for something. So it's a little different. We wasted a lot of lieutenants' time, a lot of commanders' time doing that.
Okay, and I just have a comment because for quite a long time I was an organizer for the Oregon Education Association, and we would go through, and actually we were stealing, you know, like from one union so they could come in and work for OEA.
Yes, we remember.
Be members of the OEA.
We remember that, Chair Dorsey.
Yes, yes. We used to steal them. But the most successful and whether we won or lost, organizing we do is when management would stay out of it because it was something that we had very astute management in a lot of the districts that decided it was really not a good idea for them to put their noses in it, even though they did not want us. So anyway, this is a good bill. Thank you very much for bringing it to us.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Through Shamia.
Okay, we have Alana Guinea, Barbara Bird, and Peter Keyes. And actually, unless Matt Swanson wants to come up all by himself, he could also come up with his panel. Thank you, and I may need to leave in the middle of your testimony. It's nothing personal.
Thank you for the forewarning, Chair Daugherty. Chair Daugherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ilana Guinea with the Oregon AFL-CIO. I'm going to be brief because there are far more important people here than me who can share real stories, whereas I can just retell other people's stories. But I do want to clarify a few things that this bill would and would not do that I know have come up in questions and meetings that I've had with some of your colleagues. The first is this bill won't prevent an employer from answering questions that are asked of them. This bill won't prevent an employer from receiving guidance on how to legally respond to workers who are interested in forming a union, and it won't prevent an employer from hiring an expert to help them through the contract negotiation process. Those are key things that this bill does not do where this bill still leaves a lot of flexibility. What this bill will do is ensure that we're not wasting public dollars or disrupting service delivery by having public employers take a position in a worker's consideration of forming a union. That is all this bill does. There's a small piece of it, as Representative Dembro mentioned, that addresses a fix to a bill that you passed a few sessions ago. The bulk of this bill is about keeping public dollars out of union organizing campaigns, whether it's supporting or opposing those campaigns. That's not what we should be using public dollars for. We shouldn't be distracting our public employees from delivering services effectively, and we should allow cohesive workplaces to continue whether or not workers are considering forming a union. We've got some great stories that you're going to hear about situations where this bill could have helped, about situations in the private sector that, while they wouldn't be affected by this bill, detail the need for this bill and the way that public resources could be wasted the same way that they have been in the private sector, and why that shouldn't happen. So I will let you hear those stories, and I encourage you to support this bill when it comes to a vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, my name is Barbara Bird. I'm the Secretary-Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I'm here actually not to share a story of my own, but to share some stories from workers who are not able to be here today that have been through union organizing campaigns and have experienced firsthand the impact of those campaigns on their ability to do their work. The four pieces of testimony you'll hear, three of them will be gotten to you eventually. They'll be electronically sent to you, I think. The first is a private sector example from Will Lukens, who's a member of the International Association of Machinists. Will details the disruptions in work and lost productivity that occur when managers wage these anti-union campaigns that attempt to influence workers' decisions on whether to join a union or not. I want to just quote a line or two from his testimony. He talks about captive audience meetings and fear within the workplace that ramp up. He talks about how workers start to lose motivation to organize and begin to fear for their jobs. So these are people who want a union, who have legitimate reasons for wanting to organize, and drop that motivation because of their fear and their need to hang on to their work. He says that many workers felt intimidated by the company and the union avoidance firm and its tactics, the captive audience anti-union meetings in particular. He contrasts that with the situation at IKEA, where the machinist union also has representation rights. And in that situation, IKEA has decided not to fight the union actively by spending a lot of money on anti-union campaigns, but rather to work with the union cooperatively to stay neutral in a campaign. He talks about the way absenteeism rates have declined, productivity has risen at IKEA as a result of that. The second example, and by the way, that's a private sector example, but we know, you heard Rep. Dembro testify, and we know from our own experiences that the same kinds of anti-union avoidance tactics used in the public sector have the same kinds of results. The second example is from Susan Bruce, who is with the Oregon Nurses Association, and she talks about a similar situation organizing in a hospital here in Oregon where employers attempted to bribe nurses, hold captive audience meetings, increase security and surveillance, and basically create an environment that discourages nurses from speaking out about their situation, and in particular about their support for the union. She actually witnessed managers who went so far as to tell staff that nurses involved in the organizing campaign would lose their jobs when the campaign was over. The third story, and this one moves into the public sector where we are especially concerned because this is public money being used to carry out these sorts of tactics. This is an example from Hillary Mortensen with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Hillary was a worker actually at a Head Start location in Portland, Oregon, and was involved in the campaign to start a union there. She talks about the director at that Head Start location who called all the employees into her office and talked about her baby, and she wasn't going to let the union come in between her baby and her. She used public intimidation tactics tactics and thousands of public tax dollars to hire an anti-union law firm, the EHS board discovered how much she had spent on retaining the law firm for this purpose and actually required her to stop using their reserves to represent, and she ended up having to represent herself and the Head Start company for the last day of the hearing before the board. This use of funds, this sort of careless use of public funds, resulted basically in running that Head Start operation into the ground. The Community Development Institute had to take over the program, get it back up on its feet financially. During that time, there were no repairs to school sites and so on because of the money she was spending on the anti-union campaign. Public sector workers, just like as frontline workers, often form a union to advocate for their clients, just like unionized nurses are able to advocate for patient care and firefighters for safety measures. The last thing these workers want is to see their clients, students, and communities left with less because their employer is spending money on costly law firms. But over and over, that's what we've been seeing. The final piece of testimony I'm going to let you hear in person, but I'll just conclude by saying that we really do need this bill. We need it for reasons of the public good, for the way that public monies are spent, also for the good of these workers who are faced with these kind of anti-union campaigns. So for their sake, I hope you'll support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Byrd. Well, before we move to Mr. Keyes, just to thank you for your testimony, just to clarify, this bill only applies to public sector.
I understand, and we
just use
private sector examples because we think they're parallel. We think there's similar kinds of things happen in public sector. Thank you.
Mr. Keyes?
Members of the committee, I'm Peter Keyes. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Architecture at the U of O, and we've been sort of organizing a faculty union down there since around 2009, United Academics and University of Oregon, and we actually had a car check and certified the union last spring. And the University of Oregon, starting in this process back around 2009 and continuing, has hired three firms, law firms, et cetera, to act not just in the contract negotiations, which are going on right now, but to act as consultants throughout the process and to advise the university on what we assume are sort of anti-union activities in some ways, since we don't really know in particular what the contracts really say in terms of scope of contract or how much they were paid. One of my colleagues has tried through various public information requests to get more details about this, and we've gotten heavily redacted statements on everything that's happened. I don't quite have fabulous scare stories here. No one that I know on the faculty was driven to Milwaukee for a discussion about forming union, which may become a new euphemism or something like that around the university. But we do find there were some effects in terms of our process in the past year where we could clearly see what was going on with the administration's attitude. So the Human Resources Department at the U of O had an FAQ page about unionization and tried to, under the guise of trying to put out neutral information about unionization, was really quite not, I wouldn't say, it was misinformation rather than being actual untruths. One of my colleagues characterized it at one point as saying the typical question on their website was the kind of question was, well, will the formation of a union, faculty union at the U of O, lead to the formation of a Eugene Soviet Socialist Republic? And the answer being, not necessarily, however. the direction it went in. And the way we saw this sort of filtering out was through that kind of information, and it had an effect on, I'd say, I'm a tenured faculty member, I don't have to particularly worry about stating my opinions about things and any consequences from that. But we have a lot of people at the university who do. So we have adjunct faculty who are on a contingent basis hired term by term and often at the last minute who really have to worry about how they're seen by their employers, by their immediate bosses. We have untenured faculty who are worried about pleasing everyone for 6 or 7 years so that they make it through a system without having made any enemies. And I know from experience how many of them would talk to me quietly, knowing that I was involved in trying to form the union, would talk to me quietly but really did not want it to be known that they were union supporters because they could feel a strong vibe coming from their superiors that this was, something that was not a good idea. So it created this atmosphere. It also sort of encouraged, I think, there was sort of very disingenuous statements coming from the administration that encouraged a lot of the union opponents who I think were remarkably ill-informed. you know, faculty tend to hide in their offices and labs and pay no attention to anything that doesn't directly impact them. And suddenly, a union appeared on the horizon, and a number of them sort of rose up and got very agitated and started running around. And the administration wasn't helping them with neutral information about forming a union. It was really kind of egging them on in sort of this idea of that, yes, this has to be stopped. This is a terrible idea. It's going to ruin the university. So I think what we're asking for here, and I agree completely with Representative's statement about not wanting public funds to be used in a pro-union way at all, just as much as an anti-union way. We think that I was actually, when I became aware of this bill, I was sort of surprised that such things, as you really thought about them, that such things were possible. It seems like such an obvious extension of the sort of real neutrality we try to maintain on any kind of political issues or anything like that on campus, and that there are things we can do as private individuals with freedom of speech, but clearly we're not representing the institution, and we're certainly not spending any institutional funds in furthering their goals. So I just like to offer my strong support for this bill and hope to see this become law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Keyes. Mr. Swanson, would you care to weigh in? Sorry to marginalize you over there.
It's okay. I'll take it.
We're going to open up for questions, so don't go far, please.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you can stay seated if you wish, whatever you like. Please.
Matt Swanson with the Service Employees International Union. For the record, we are here in support of this bill today. I'm not going to take too much of your time. I think our position is consistent with others who spoke in favor of this bill. We've had experiences, certainly through workers trying to form unions and state agencies like the Oregon Courts, Teachers and Standards and Practices, recyclers at the Portland State University, and various other agencies. I think that it's common for workers to feel a certain level of just intimidation by the fact that there is a control placed over your workday, your livelihood, by an employer, so that speech tends to have a lot of weight. Certainly employers need guidance, but I do think there needs to be a certain space for workers to debate whether or not they wish to form a union, and I think this bill gives them adequate space to do so. In addition, the union avoidance consulting industry can be quite expensive. Typically these fees can cost quite a bit of money. We had an experience with a small nonprofit in Corvallis where they brought in essentially a union consultant daily to talk to workers, to be in the worksite, to use that space to run an anti-union campaign that cost many thousands of dollars in a space that was really struggling to provide services. So I think that we support the goals of this legislation and certainly would like to see this pass on to the floor for a vote.
Thank you. Let's open up to questions. Would the panel mind, I'm sorry to, the four of you mind awkwardly squeezing up there? Sorry to do that. Questions?
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Yeah, Representative Thatcher.
I'm not sure how to phrase this exactly because I might not have the terminology down correctly, but I hope you can understand what I'm trying to get at. Okay, so you don't want any outside consultants or money being spent on outside consultants for the management to resist. Are there any outside consultants, so to speak, who come in to help the employees and guide them and consult them? Go ahead.
Vice Chair Barton, Representative Thatcher, there's a few ways I can answer that. I think, first of all, it's important to note that what we're talking about is specifically how we are using money and consultants both to support or oppose union organizing from the management side. Generally, we talk about forming a union and the question of whether or not to form a union is a decision that workers should be making. Often those workers are working with a union that is already in existence. That's not always the case, though. So when they are working with a union that is in existence, they have that group that is often supporting them. But in terms of hiring consultants outside of that, that's not something that we see. I also want to clarify again that this is not stating that management can't answer questions. Where there are factual questions asked by workers of their managers, they're absolutely allowed to answer those questions. We're just talking about management as a whole taking a position spending resources to support whatever that position is, and taking work time that should be used to, in the public sector, whether it's deliver services, educate students, protect our communities, and using that time instead to weigh in, as opposed to using that time for work.
Follow-up?
I guess a follow-up, yes. Is when there is an outside union, existing union, already working with the employees, is there any monetary benefit to these outside people or financial interest in seeing that this unionization of these employees happens?
Vice Chair Barton, Representative Thatcher, not during the organizing process. If workers form a union as a member of an existing union, generally there are dues that go into helping to maintain contracts and to represent workers if any violations of a contract come up, but that monetary relationship does not exist until a contract is negotiated, so not at all during an organizing process.
Well, I understand that not during the organization, but to see that it happens, that they are organized, there would be a benefit to the existing union, correct?
Vice Chair Barton, Representative Thatcher, in the form of dues, yes, that is how unions are run.
Any other questions for this panel? You guys got off surprisingly easy.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, actually. Thank you for coming. And Professor Keyes, thanks for driving up from Eugene. That's all we have signed up for House Bill 3342. Would anyone else like to testify on this bill today? Like I said, that we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3342, and we are going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2535. I believe it was already summarized before Representative Holvey's testimony earlier this morning. We also have...
Would you like me to go again, Mr. Chair?
May I offer a suggestion?
We have four people signed up, and if you don't mind, like the last time, we're going to awkwardly ask the four of you to come up all at once. There's Alma Cazares, Marlinda Neumeyer, Larry Harvey, and John Schultz, please.
So they say good things.
And Mr. Schultz, it just occurred to me, would you like to testify in the next panel or separately? It occurred to me you're not necessarily with this group.
I could do either, whichever you prefer.
Tell you what, why don't we call you up right after this panel testifies?
Sure.
Thanks for your patience. Go ahead in any order you wish. Thanks for coming, but be sure to identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Alma Casares, and I am the branch manager for the local Salem Labor Ready. And what we do is we put people to work on a daily basis to your general labor, construction firms, manufacturing industries, hospitality. And so today we're here just to, if you have any questions, we'd be more than happy to answer them. And this is Marlinda Neumeyer, and she will be reading testimony this morning.
Thank you, Representative Barton, Representative Holvey, and the committee members for allowing me to talk to you today about HB 2535. As Alma said, my name is Marlinda Neumeyer, and I'm the market manager for CLP Resources, a True Blue company. My office is located in Portland, and I serve skilled tradespeople and businesses throughout the state. Representative Holvey has worked with True Blue and the Oregon Staffing Association and has explained that his goal is to prevent a customer of a temporary staffing firm from directly paying a temporary employee during the same pay period that the staffing firm provides and pays the same employee. Although this practice is quite rare, in our experience, we agree that it should never happen and it should be stopped. Representative Holvey's intent was not reflected in the original language of this bill, and as drafted, it would be quite detrimental to the staffing industry. We'd like to thank Representative Holvey for recognizing that and working with temporary staffing to find a way to end abusive practice committed by some business clients while ensuring the ease of compliance. Our primary concern with this bill was to minimize the administrative burden on staffing companies so we can spend our time and resources looking for jobs for our employees. Our one primary concern, really and truly, was having to give a document to an employee at the beginning of each and every assignment. for my company, with CLP only having one branch in the entire state, I have employees in Klamath Falls. I have employees in Medford. I have employees in Ontario. They cannot realistically drive to Portland to get a piece of paper. We give them all that information over the phone so that they have everything that is expected, the hours, the duration, who their supervisor is, the company that they work for. We tell them all of that at the time. So I wanted to keep this brief. I know that when we were here last time, it got very time-consuming. So, again, we very much support the concept behind Representative Hulvey's bill, and we'll continue to work with him to craft a bill that ends this practice while allowing us to focus on finding more jobs for our employees. Do you guys have any questions?
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Absolutely.
I'm sorry. You had that phrase, intent is not to pay, and then I lost the rest of that phrase. And that's a critical point. I'm sorry. I just
it is.
It.
His intent for the bill was reflected, where was I at? The intent was not, as drafted, it would have been detrimental to the staffing industry. Because the intent there was not for us to have to give a piece of paper every single time we put out an assignment. It was to make sure that the employee and the client had the information that they can't both be paid in the same.
But it was also about paying twice.
Right, and that is something we agree with. They shouldn't be paid twice in the same pay period.
Director Hammer, if I may, I'm with True Blue.
If you can come up, you need to identify yourself.
Sorry. I'm Natalie McNair Huff with True Blue. We're the parent company of both Labor Ready and CLP. The intent, as explained to us by Representative Hulvey, is to prevent our business clients from simultaneously paying our temporary employees while we are also providing that temporary employee to the same client.
Thank you.
So let's say construction company A hires us to send them a worker or a few workers for 8 hours a week, and then they put them on their own books for 32 hours a week. And then when the employee gets injured, they'll say, oh, that was during your 8 hours. And so that was the intent that was explained to us with Representative
Hulvey. Perfect. That's just what I needed to know. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate your testimony and the fact you're working with the representative, because I agree with what he's trying to accomplish here. And I think if we can narrow the scope and get that, we'll have a better situation for all of us. And I really appreciate your testimony on the part that I was struggling with in the Dash 2 amendment, which was the written acknowledgement, because it not only forces you to provide it, but it also has the employee acknowledging it in written format as well. And I think that could be problematic. But
it's very
again, I encourage you to continue to work with them,
yes,
because as you see, he's well-intended. I say that often.
Absolutely.
About my good friend. But he's well-intended. We're trying to get somewhere. And thank you very much.
No, we appreciate
there.
That.
Thank you.
You're fine. Thank you. I came in the middle. Oh, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. You know, I don't mind the concept either. I think it's fine. But I was curious, having been a customer of temp agencies, isn't it against your rules, so to speak, or your contracts, to even allow such a scenario?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Just want to clarify.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, thank you. And that's a good point. I think it is, but I think the problem exists, if it does exist, and I believe it probably does, that they're never aware that occurs. The employee themselves, not from the temp agency or the contractor, but the actual employee, is making the agreement to, okay, I'll stay on the site for this long because the temp agency hired me for 16 hours. I'll stay for the additional 24 if you're going to pay me that way. But like as Representative Hulvey said, when the employee falls off the roof, then which hour period are they being covered by and which workers' comp kicks in? Because you're providing a workers' comp and the contractor themselves that hired the temp is not.
Right.
So that's problematic. So, I totally get it. Shouldn't occur, but in today's world where everybody's struggling to make a dollar and they're taking work when they can, it's probably occurring more these days than it has in the past.
Okay. I came in the middle, so I assume we've finished the panel.
Thank you.
Mr. Harvey.
Representative Doherty, for the record, my name is Larry Harvey. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Staffing Association today, and that's a statewide trade and professional association for staffing agency owners, managers, operators, et cetera. So I'm not certain that there's much more that I can add. Marlinda has done a very good job of articulating the problem, and thank you, Representative Matthews, for pointing out exactly what happens. And we don't authorize it as a rule of thumb. One of the discussions that we've had even this morning with Representative Holvey was the understanding that as we're working through the amendments, the next set of amendments would actually articulate more clearly that the intention is upon being hired by the temp agency, the employee would acknowledge that that is one of the rules. So we want to get that out of the way up front, that once they've gone through their screening, once they've had their done their skills testing and so on, that all happens before the client of the temporary agency actually requests an employee. So our intention is to make sure that those rules, if you will, are all not only clearly understood, but then the new employee of the temporary staffing agency signs says, yes, I understand that. I've received a copy of the rules, and I understand that I'm not supposed to do that. So we're just trying to protect the employee. We want to make sure that if the employee is injured on the job, they're covered. The temporary staffing agency becomes the employer of record when we do the hiring. So we're trying to make sure that as the employer of record, we're properly paying workers' compensation, we're properly protecting the employee, and making sure that they are covered on the job, and that they're not there for an additional 20 or so hours, and suddenly, that doesn't count towards workers' compensation, whether it's for the injury or the time off paid. So we do also support what Representative Holvey's intention is. Our ambition is to get through this so that we can move this bill to a work session and give you a final product.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Matthews?
Thank you. And just to be clear, nothing in the bill would prohibit then the employee from your agency that goes out to provide the work, if they impress this contractor to the point where they say, I want to get this person on staff, they can then break from your agency and become a full-time employee for that contractor, and then they're responsible for them from that day forward.
Yes, Chair Doherty, Representative Matthews, yes, we have specifically addressed that in there, that and explained and described what that transition would be, so that if they are working for the temporary agency, that's the employee of record, and the employee and the client are both perfectly free to make that conversion or transfer, so that the employee then goes directly to work for the employer, whatever that nature of that employment might be.
Thank you. Any other questions of the panel? Okay, is everyone has testified?
We have.
We all.
Sure. Okay, all up here. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for taking your time and coming down here. Do you want to bring these two together?
I don't know. She just came up to answer the question. So it's just
okay. John Schultz, UCBS.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Schultz. I'm with the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm going to be pretty brief this morning. We just wanted to also acknowledge that we've been working with Representative Holvey on this bill. Our understanding of the evolving amendments is that they are not going to require additional regulatory activities from the Workers' Compensation Division, so we don't expect there to be a fiscal on this bill. Instead, as a matter of course, in our investigations or audits, when we find a violation like what has been discussed, we would review that documentation accordingly, as we do now. And under whatever the final amendments would be, that we would take the appropriate action accordingly. So to be more specific about that, we wanted to make sure that the committee understood that as the bill is written now, if a client employer of a temporary service company was both bringing in and working with the employee of a temporary service company, and inappropriately then also using them and paying them as labor in their business, then that client business would be subject, as the bill stands now, subject to penalties as a non-compliant employer under the workers' compensation statute. And I wanted to be available here to answer any questions if anybody had questions on that one piece or anything else I might be able to help you with. And with that, I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Mr. Schultz? Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And since we're still kind of working through amendments, I'll just kind of keep this brief. But in the instance where you have a temp agency send out their worker, and that worker is in this agreement that nobody knows about except for the worker and the contractor themselves, and an injury occurs. Have you ever had a situation where somebody were to file for workers' comp and then we have this dispute over they are or they're not covered?
Madam Chair, Representative Matthews, yes, we have those occurrences, and then it's our job to investigate that and to try to straighten out who the actual employer is. Of course, in some instances, it'll be the temporary service provider who has workers' compensation insurance, and we proceed from there. On occasion, it is not the temporary service provider, actually. It's the client business who does not have workers' compensation insurance on occasion, and then they become what we refer to as a non-compliant employer, and they're subject to penalties through the workers' compensation statute.
And follow-up? Mm-hmm. And so for the individual then that's impacted by injury, what happens to them in that case?
Madam Chair, Representative Matthews, they get their claims costs covered through either the non-compliant employer, who becomes ultimately liable for the claims costs as well as civil penalties, as well as the administrative costs to adjudicate that claim, which can be quite a bit of money depending on what kind of claim you're talking about, or if they are unable to pay for that, the actual payment then is made by all other complying employers within the system.
Thank you. Thanks for your work.
Any other questions? I kind of have a technical one, and as I say, I missed part of the hearing. With the temporary agencies, do they have like a blanket workers' comp policy? Because obviously they're not, don't have a policy for Mike Jones and Emple Smith, and is it just a blanket policy?
Yes, Madam Chair. They have their workers' compensation policy to cover their employees, and there are employees coming and going in under that scenario. So it's somewhat of a challenge for the insurance companies typically to determine what the risk is, but they do that, and they charge premium accordingly to those temporary service companies, and they have workers' compensation insurance to cover their risk.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Any other questions, Mr. Schultz? Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Okay. And I think we've heard from everybody. Is there anyone else that would like to speak on this bill? Okay, seeing none, I close the public works of a public session on House Bill 2535, and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3347. Would you like to summarize the bill, please?
Good, Madam Chair, committee members. This bill prohibits the manufacturer, the distributor, the importer from requiring a vehicle dealer to construct or remodel the dealer facility within 10 years of the last construction or remodel. Prohibits the manufacturer, the distributor, the importer from requiring the vehicle dealer to enter into an agreement or an incentive program to buy or lease certain goods or services. And it prohibits the franchisor from increasing the price of a vehicle or imposing surcharges to recover costs of paying the dealer's claim for parts and labor under warranty. There are no amendments before you.
Okay. Since this has been Franchisor Week, I assume you gentlemen will explain your franchise system.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Tom Gallagher representing the Oregon Auto Dealers, and with me is Paul Cosgrove, who represents the Oregon Automobile Manufacturers. So we're here on a relationship that manufacturers and dealers have called franchise agreements, and a great many companies have franchises and so forth. This just happens to be one which is somewhat regulated by state statute in all states. So the contract or the franchise agreement between manufacturers and Oregon auto dealers has statutory provisions that are required in the contracts. The bill in front of you actually amends a couple of those provisions. It amends a provision on facility upgrades, on product outsourcing, and surcharging of warranty work. Rather than go into the details of all of those right now, we are involved in intergalactic contact with the manufacturers and in discussions that take place in Portland and Salem and so forth, and we hope to be able to conclude the details of some of the changes in the franchise statute by next week. With that, other than answering your questions about franchise agreements, I can't tell you exactly how those discussions will come out.
Okay. Mr. Cosgrove, would you like to get back in the galaxy and
Madam Chair,
your testimony?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. I always know it's going to be amusing when I appear with my friend Tom Gallagher. The difference between, I know you've had, as you point out, issues involving franchises in other contexts, and Mr. Gallagher mentioned it, but this is a case in which, in this relationship, auto manufacturers and auto dealers, you actually write the contract here in Salem, in essence, in a great deal of detail. The financial arrangements, the exclusive territories that are granted, all of that is actually done in statute, where in most franchise agreements, with a few restrictions that a legislature puts on in a general franchise statute, most franchises, the McDonald's or somebody else like that, it's essentially a bargaining between the two parties. This is one where you actually write the contract. We are, the details of this arrangement are being worked out. There have been some significant meetings already. There's a lot of paper flowing back and forth. I think Mr. Gallagher might be a little bit optimistic about concluding that all by next week, but we are working diligently together to bring you what we hope is at least a narrowed down list of concerns where there isn't agreement. We may reach agreement on all of them. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions as well.
Okay. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I enjoy this job because you learn something new every day. I actually had no idea that this body essentially established the franchisee, franchisor contract in this context, and I don't recall it coming up in my previous term here. How often do one of your organizations come to this organization? How often do we tinker with this contract?
Madam Chair,
it's like a once a decade Biden, thing. Is it like a every session?
From the perspective of the automobile dealers, not nearly enough. From the perspective of the manufacturers, I'm sure it's an arduous task of having to constantly negotiate with us. In practical point, a couple of things happen out there in the real world. The programs, the incentive programs, et cetera, between the automobile and manufacturers, the advertising, the signage, et cetera, all of those things designed for everybody to be successful in selling cars change all the time. There's new technology that comes into play. We just went through a downturn in the automobile industry a few years ago where a number of franchises were closed, et cetera. So there's always, and let me call it in a positive sense, there's always the tension out there between two very powerful groups that are trying to achieve the same objective, but they're two businesses dealing with each other. So there are two ways in which we, from the Automobile Dealers Association side, look at this. And one way is when we have some problems here in the state. A few years ago, we had one with some closures of dealerships, and there was some changes in the statute that we brought in because we felt that could have been done differently and better, and I think everybody's agreed that the new process will work. In other times, that there are changes across the country that other dealerships, other associations have worked out that we then try to duplicate. Those, I think, really are the discussion points. And yeah, you might have done it in New Jersey, but why do you need it here? And I think that's a lot of what we're in right now.
If I may, Madam Chair, Representative Barton, more specifically, how often? It's a biennial exercise. It has been recently. Now that the legislature meets annually, we've actually even had an even year exercise. So from our perspective, far too often. far too often.
I guess I just
and in fact,
don't remember it.
We hope that the discussions that we conclude this time will allow you to put this set of statutes to rest for more than another 2 years, for maybe four or six. Because Mr. Gallagher is correct, there are certain things that are not part of the statute that do change all the time between the parties as normal business arrangements. But the involvement of you folks in the basic parts of the contract, we would prefer to try to set that and leave it for a while. Thank you.
Representative Fagan?
Thank you. Actually, I think Mr. Gallagher, alluded to what my question was going to be, was if this is in response to the situation with Rasmussen and Mercedes-Benz USA. I know that there was essentially a selling of that franchise in response to Mercedes-Benz insisting on them changing facilities. I didn't know if this was at least aimed at that situation.
Madam Chair, Representative Fagan, none of the provisions in this contract would deal with that situation. Okay. Those were things that were settled, I believe, through litigation.
Okay. Right.
Okay, any other questions? I didn't realize that like Representative Barton, we had this kind of, authority, and but I can see from both sides, you want to make sure that your cars are sold in a facility that is, up to par with the cars that you are selling. So
exactly correct.
Anyway, so there are amendments on this. Anybody, any other questions? Okay, thank you. Anyone else?
Thank
so those
you.
Are the only two we have signed up. Anybody else to speak on House Bill 3347? Mm-hmm. Okay, if not, I close a public hearing on House Bill 3347. We have many work sessions, but we have some of our people gone. So why don't we stand down for about 10 minutes? And we'll see if they come back. If not, we do have a quorum that we'll be able to pass some things on for a work session.
9:10, Madam Chair.
Pardon?
9:10, we'll be back.
Yes.
Okay.
the hearings for the House Committee on Business and Labor, and we are going to open a work session on House Bill 2698. Jan, if you could summarize the bill, please.
Yes, Madam Chair, committee members. This is the bill that was before you on March 1st. It's with the Building Codes Division to extend their pilot program for building inspectors. And there is an amendment before you, the dash one. I believe we're going to have Mark Long from the Building Codes Division address that amendment.
Okay.
The dash one has no revenue impact, and there is a minimal fiscal impact with no statement issued.
Thank you. Mr. Long?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Long. I'm the Administrator of State Building Codes, which are part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I have Chris Huntington from my office as well to answer any questions that you may have. Just to remind the committee, you know, we set uniform standards for construction. We work with the 130 different jurisdictions out there, and we certify the building inspectors that provide those inspections in areas of plumbing, electrical, structural, mechanical, et cetera, within the local communities. This bill is an extension of work that we had in 2009 to create a more flexible training and education program, primarily for rural areas, but also impacting many of the urban areas, to where we can create custom cross-training programs, programs that would provide for regional certifications. The Dash 1 amendments are a complete replacement of the bill, which is interesting. We asked Legislative Council why they drafted it that way, and they indicated because of changes to Section 2, which we'll all go over, and frankly, Chuck Taylor's done such an outstanding job of drafting our legislation this year that we didn't question his wisdom on wanting to create a complete rewrite of the bill. The primary differences in the Dash 1 is we've added a field evaluation component to where if somebody comes in from out of state or in other matters, we can review the qualifications based on actually observing somebody in the field, how well they know what they're doing, and then set a training level based upon their competency, based on our exact observations of their work. We also added in the Dash 1s that are different from the bill that we're going to consult with our stakeholders. I forgot to mention we have 7 advisory boards at building codes that consult on matters of code, training, and education, and this would have us run these programs through those boards. We also, in the Dash 1, wanted to make sure that the standards that we set only apply to the workers, the inspectors in the government, and this doesn't impact licensees, electricians, and plumbers. We also license those individuals, so no impact there. And then we wanted to clarify that we could set standards based on the geographic and regional areas. And so those are kind of the changes, if you will, between Dash 1s and Dash and the original bill. But the overall concept is greater flexibility. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Okay, fine. Are there any questions? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Long. Sorry I didn't get this question to you in advance, but I don't think it's too difficult. So in terms of, you know, the training and certification of the building inspectors, is there ever any review of the work performed by building inspectors and whether they're, living up to the training and the standards that have been established?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Holdy, not as an ongoing basis, but there is continued education that's required of each inspector once they become certified at the level, and they're required a certain amount of time every year, every 3 years, depending upon the code change, to be updated. And, of course, we have authority, and this bill doesn't address that, but you may even, I don't know if it's captured in the laws that were picked up, but we have authority to make investigations and to enforce standards when we get complaints. And we do that, and I have revoked certifications. I've limited certifications. I've done a variety of different things when we find folks aren't carrying out the public interest, which is the standard for inspectors.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for that answer.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Chris is with my office. He's just going to help me with if you had questions on the amendments, because he was instrumental in drafting and running the program for us.
Thank you. So you get off. Did you have a question?
No, ma'am.
Okay, you get off easy this morning. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Would you like a motion?
Okay.
Chair Doherty, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2698.
Okay, Representative Barton moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2698. Is there any discussion? Okay, is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2698 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2698 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Thatcher.
Well, I know initially that there were a number of entities that testified in support. Are we just to assume that this one... It doesn't sound like there's any substantial changes, that it's still positive and goes the direction that many of these people wanted, such as AOI, the counties, the manufactured home people, the Building Managers Association, Marion County. I mean, there's a whole bunch of people that can testify and support the original language, and I just want to at least get a nod or two from people in the audience that it's still good. Thank you. That is the affirmative.
Let the record show there was a nod or two out in the audience. Okay, thank you. Any other discussion? Okay, seeing none. Brandon, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Matthews.
Not affirmatively. Yes.
Representative Bolby.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Fagan.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Whitehorn.
He's excused.
Vice Chair Representative Kenner.
Excused.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye. Okay, motion passes.
Do you want to have Representative Nathanson carry that?
It is her bill.
Pardon? Representative Nathanson. Carry
Representative Nathanson, it was her bill. She will carry the bill on the floor. We'll ask her to carry it on the floor. Okay, just for information, House Bill 2706 will carry over that until Monday. There's an amendment that has not come back on that yet. Okay, Benefits Corp. Mm-hmm. Okay, open the work session on House Bill 2296. Jan, if you could summarize.
Madam Chair, committee members, this is the bill that sets up the benefit companies. You have before you a dash 3 amendment that modifies the approval process, and that was discussed at the hearing in March 18th. You have a new amendment, the dash 4 amendment, that specifies that there will be no special contracting preference or tax advantage to any benefit company. And I believe there might be someone here to speak to that amendment or to ask if you have questions.
Okay.
There's no fiscal impact on the Dash 3 amendment. There's no revenue impact, but we have no analysis yet on the Dash 4 amendment.
Okay. So we're pretty much talking about the Dash 4 amendments, and then...
Yes, the committee could choose to adopt the Dash 3 and the Dash 4, or one but not the other. Just cannot move the bill out today.
Okay, thank you for the clarification. Is there anyone here to speak on the Dash amendments?
I like the Dash 4 amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay. Because that was the one that we're having a little problem with. Thank you very much. If you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gina Zedlick. I'm Legislative Director for the Secretary of State, Kate Brown. We discussed the Dash 3 amendments at our last hearing here, and that's the one that we would... definitely advocate for inclusion on the bill. On the Dash 4 amendments, we've seen it, and although we don't disagree with the truth of the statement that it's in the Dash 4, that nothing in the bill gives any sort of advantage or otherwise benefits these companies specifically because they are a benefit company, and I can only speak to this as sort of from a general legal perspective, as I am not a corporate lawyer, but I think that our concern with adding the Dash 4s in and adding the separate section that just sort of clarifies that Sections 1 through 11 don't do certain things. We would say that Sections 1 through 11 don't purport to do any of those things, and so instead we would rather see language maybe included in statements of intent, maybe whereas clauses, just to clarify the legislature's intent rather than a substantive section of the bill, just in case our fears are down the line if anything came up before a court. Courts generally interpret the legislature to adopt sections that independently have meaning, and so we're just, that would be our concern with the Dash 4 speaking.
Okay, any questions of the panelists? Representative Fagan and Barton and Bolby.
More of just a comment, but I just wanted to express that I agree. I'm not a fan of the dash fours either. I know that we received an email from Mr. Campbell, and I had actually, his email just confirmed how I was feeling about it when I was looking at them last night. When you look at creating an LLC, there's no statement saying this does not create there's no special treatment. If you create a sole corporation or a Inc., there's no, there's no statement saying we don't create special treatment. So to just single out this one type of corporation and say it doesn't get special treatment, I believe will actually create the opposite effect, and the courts might more scrutinize that, or maybe, not necessarily the courts, but any kind of enforcing agency might actually scrutinize a benefit corporation more so than they would just because of that statement being there and not being in other form, formation of other corporate form statutes. So I'm also in agreement that certainly we're all expressing an intent in legislative history to not create a special class or treatment, and I certainly would be comfortable putting that in a policy statement or, as Mr. Campbell suggests, in a whereas. I'm not comfortable putting it in a statute either out of fear that we would actually create the opposite effect, that it would be more highly scrutinized.
Thank you. Representative Barton, yeah. Holvey, and then Thatcher.
Madam Chair, to weigh in, I've previously expressed my opinion that this bill doesn't actually do much. It's not that big of a deal. The Dash 4 amendment similarly doesn't actually do much. It's not that big of a deal. So we're kind of having a disagreement over a disagreement, none of which is particularly important in my humble opinion. However, having said that, I think Ms. Edlich is quite correct. The courts, believe it or not, actually assume that perhaps we're more competent than we in fact are. they will assume that we did that for a reason. And on the other hand, I think Representative Kenemer is the primary proponent of the amendment. I do get where he's coming from. We've jokingly called it the paranoid amendment. I think there are ways to accomplish, assuage his paranoia on this, and I don't mean that in a deprecating way, without the Dash 4 amendment. Again, whereas clauses might do it. I think it's already been beaten to death in legislative history. Anyway, I think there's a way to get there.
Okay, thank you. Representative Holvey and then Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the Dash 4 amendment, which I sort of alluded to that I liked, and I somewhat, I can understand the legal aspects of that, but I actually believe that it would behoove the legislature to actually state that these B corporations are not intended to receive special tax treatment. I will refer you and others to a man named Andrew Kasoy, who is the co-founder of B-Lab, who is one of those companies who helped invent B corporations and also certifies them to some sort of profit model as well. But in June 2010, he had a huge article on the legal structure of B corporations, and I will quote from him right now. He says, one of the reasons for the new corporate from instead of just saying old constituency statutes is to create clarity that this can't just be an excuse by directors to avoid takeovers or to entrench their own interests. A company has to be creating general public benefit and improving it through use of third-party standard. The Holy Grail, notes Kasoy, will be to use this new corporate form as a platform for states or municipalities or federal governments to offer procurement, investment, or tax incentives for benefit companies. So in the dream scenario, when you have companies obligated to create public benefit, you can measure their externalities. The externalities of those companies are internalizing and saying they should be taxed at a lower rate than a C corporation. And it goes on to say that throughout the United States now, there are several areas in the country that are now giving these B corporations special tax status and special tax incentives. And so I caution this legislature, if their intent is not to create a corporate form that is going to be able to accept tax credits and seems to be the intent of forming these B corporations, that we tread lightly in this and maybe make a statement in statute about their special tax treatment or potential special tax treatment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Thatcher.
along with what Representative Fagan was saying, pointing one form of business out might not be the way to go. Perhaps just saying any form of business, just by virtue of being a particular form of business, does not get a special treatment. Just throwing that out there. I wasn't sure what the relating clause was. I hadn't gotten to the bill yet, but.
I think any more comments or questions or whatever. Thank you very much. Since we still have two amendments out on this and some questions and so on, we're going to reschedule this to give time to address the preference issue in possibly a different amendment. And since we don't know that, the time is to be arranged. Okay. Did I want a work session? And so we're going to close the work session on House Bill 2296 and open up a work session on House Bill 2643.
Madam Chair and committee members, this bill directs the Office of Secretary of State to study the amount and the impact of state and local government fees on small businesses and to develop strategies for lessening the impact on small businesses. The bill was heard by the committee on February 8th. There are no amendments before you. There's no revenue impact. There is an impact statement issued that just came in while we were in this meeting. I think you have a copy before you. And there is a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means.
Okay. Representative McEwen, I want to speak on this. Representative McEwen.
Good morning, Chair Doherty. Vice Chair Barton, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Caddy McEwen. I am the representative from House District 9 from Coos Bay to Yahats on the South Coast. I'm very happy to be here this morning. I'm here to speak very briefly about House Bill 2643. As you've heard already, the bill directs the Secretary of State to conduct a study of fees imposed on small businesses by local and state agencies. I think like many, if not most in the building, I spent months knocking on doors and talking to folks, and what I heard primarily was we need to put people back to work, we need jobs, we need to help this economy recover, particularly in my corner of the state that's been very hard hit by the recession. I would like to identify a problem or see if there is a problem. Without a study, we're not going to know if we actually have an issue that we can deal with. This bill and the study it authorizes offers us an opportunity to take a global view of fee structures that impact small businesses, particularly startups. Are there ways to mitigate the burden up front by extending a period of time over which they may be paid or allowing businesses to pay certain percentages in the future over a timely manner that can help them as they try to mitigate startup costs? There are unanswered questions, and to that end, we believe that allowing the Secretary of State to conduct this study, take a look at the information that she will gather with that study, we can hopefully offer some solutions to small businesses as they're beginning to try and put people back to work in the state. I've had a conversation with the Secretary of State. She believes that her office has the capacity to manage this. She is supportive of the bill and would like to have this tool in her toolbox as a way to begin to use her small business portal very effectively and a way to move forward with another initiative that she is proposing that has to do with opening an Office of Small Business, and I've forgotten the name of it, Courtney? Office of Small Business Assistance, to take one step further in assisting the recovery of the economy in the state. With that, I'll close. Unless you have any specific questions, she believes there's capacity in her office financially to manage this project, and we're hoping we can move it forward and assist our businesses to grow.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Representative? Okay, thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2643 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay, Chair Barton moves that House Bill 2643 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I love it.
Yeah, we will have that for the record. Okay, seeing none, Brandon, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Holdy.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Weisinger.
Excused.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Fagan.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Parker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kenneman.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. We don't need a carrier on this bill.
Thank you
very much. At this point, we don't need a carrier. Okay, so I close the work session on House Bill 2643 and open a work session on House Bill 3243. Jan, can you summarize?
Yes.
House Bill 3243 allows certain deceased members of PERS to be considered vested for purposes under the pension program. Declares an emergency effective on passage. Committee heard the bill and discussed the Dash 1 amendment at a time that specifies that the member must have been killed in the line of duty between July 1 and December 31 of 2011. There's no revenue impact. There is a minimal fiscal impact, and there is a referral to Joint Ways and Means.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, before I move to adopt amendments, I just wanted to call out, because I know he's entirely too humble, Representative Matthews, as many of us discussed about, he's dropped a priority bill to broaden this so that it can apply to more fallen officers that should, God forbid, should they accrue in the future. But having said that, Chair Doherty, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3243.
Okay, Representative Barton moves the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3243. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3243 to the floor with the due pass as amended recommendation and be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay. Representative Barton moves House Bill 3243 to the floor with due pass as amended recommendation and be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, Brandon, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Whitener.
Excused.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Bacon.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kenneman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. Again, no carrier is needed since it's been referred to Ways and Means. Okay, I close the work session on House Bill 3243 and open a work session on House Bill 3343.
Madam Chair, committee members, this bill modifies Port of Portland's authority to establish best value contract standards and criteria. There are no amendments before you. You heard the bill March 18th. No revenue impact. There is a minimal fiscal impact, but no statement issued, and there is no subsequent referral.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3343 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Barton moves House Bill 3343 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Brandon, could you call the roll?
Representative Bacon.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
No.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Whitener.
Excused.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kenneman.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. Okay, the carrier, Speaker Kotek is chief sponsor, but Kenemer is also a sponsor. Representative Kenemer, would you like to carry it?
With my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, with that, I close the work session on House Bill 3343.
Which bill?
Bill 2698.
Madam Chair, I move to suspend the rules to allow Representative Kenemer to vote in House Bill 2698.
Okay, is there any objection? Okay, seeing none. Representative Kenemer, how do you vote?
Aye.
Okay, Representative Kenemer votes aye.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for the courtesy.
Thank you very much. No other business? Okay, with that, I close the Committee on House Labor and Business for the 27th of March 27th, 2013. We will not be meeting on Friday. We will all be meeting in our districts. Okay, thank you very much.
Happy to.